Hello, everyone. This is John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com, and we have another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin for you. Today's guest is Christian Dobratz. Chris is an assistant professor at Minnesota State University in Mankato. He was a police officer for 18 years and now teaches in the Criminal Justice Department. And Chris and I encountered each other as part of a stress management program that one of our partner organizations, Trans Personnel Consulting Group, was doing. And Chris has a fascinating story. He has experienced post-traumatic stress disorder firsthand, and he has also unfortunately become disabled and is no longer able to work as a police officer. And Christian, may I call you Chris, first of all?
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you very much for being here, and I found your story to be fascinating. And I'm wondering if you would please share it with our audience and maybe go through a little bit of your history in law enforcement and tell us certainly about what you're doing now at MSU in Mankato. And also let's talk about PTSD, and then maybe later we'll talk about your experiences with a disability.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, first of all, thanks, John, for inviting me. My pleasure to be here. As you stated, I worked in law enforcement for 18 years. Started my career back in 1991 when I was actually going through college, getting my undergraduate degree at Minnesota State Mankato, where I happen to be now. And I started with an agency called Hutchinson Police Services in Minnesota. It's about 65 miles west of Minneapolis-St. Paul. It's a city of about, currently it's about maybe 14, 15,000, and we had about 23, 24 sworn officers at the time when I retired in 2008. So I started my career there part-time while I was in college. I also worked for our county sheriff's department here in McLeod County at the same time. Then in 1994, I graduated and had my full-time license activated at Hutchinson for about 9 months, and then I got hired by our neighboring county to the east, Carver County Sheriff's Department, which is a part of the seven-county metro area. I got hired there essentially as kind of a juvenile detective. I spent half my time working at an alternative school as a liaison officer, and the other half of my time was spent primarily doing child protection investigations. Then in 1998, while I was still with Carver County, I took an assignment to the Southwest Metro Drug Task Force. And we were basically a joint partner, or a multi-agency, I should say, drug task force, really focusing kind of on street-level narcotics. And we had a four-county area. In Minnesota, it was the counties of Carver, Scott County, which is another metro county, portions of western Hennepin County to the north, which is another metro county, and then McLeod County, where Hutchinson was at. Mm-hmm. So we primarily, there was two or three agents at any time and a supervisor, and we focused on narcotics in that area. In 2000, I went back to work full-time as a detective for Hutchinson Police Services, and they allowed me to stay on and finish my third year on the drug task force. So my first 8 months with Hutchinson were still on the drug task force. And then for the remaining 4 months, I moved into the regular detective position. And then in 2001, I was promoted to detective sergeant for the agency. So for the last 7 years of my career, I oversaw the detective division, which included the drug task force, an agent assigned to the drug task force, a full-time child protection officer, school liaison, and a general investigator. And then I also supervised the records division and then would occasionally assist with patrol duties as a watch commander when that was needed. The only other primary functions that I took over, I started receiving training in 2001 with computer forensics, and for those last 7 years, I also served as a forensic analyst and as a investigator with the Minnesota Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, primarily focusing on child pornography and individuals who were, you know, trying to abduct, molest, seduce children online. Mm-hmm. So that was primarily what I did. In 2008, I started. I'll go back a little bit here. I actually started my law enforcement career with kind of an existing back injury, if you'd say. I was from high school football. Mm-hmm. A year after I started in law enforcement is when I needed my first surgery. So 1992 was my first back surgery. And that actually held up until about 2006. And 2006, started experiencing problems again, ended up having two surgeries in 2006, did not successfully fix the problem, and this was all dealing with low back and disc problems. 2008, in the spring, a decision was finally made to have my low back fused in the hope that that was going to finally fix my problems. And when I essentially awoke from the surgery and they had a chance to decompress all the nerves, I ended up with bigger problems. I ended up with a drop foot and basically just chronic nerve pain and low back pain that just does not still to this day go away. I could not get clearance from my doctor to return to law enforcement. So in June of 2008, I retired medically from law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And then in August of that same year, I was fortunate enough to be hired as a fixed-term faculty member, serving as an assistant professor in the law enforcement program at Minnesota State Mankato. And that's currently where I'm at. Minnesota State has a student population of about 16,000 students. We have a four-year Bachelor of Science or Bachelor of Arts degree in law enforcement. Mm. And we've got about roughly 460 students enrolled in our law enforcement program. And primarily the courses that I teach in that program are police tactics. I teach a course in narcotics investigations. I teach a course entitled Police Emergency Response Procedures. And then lastly, and probably one of my more favorite courses, not favorite, but kind of my specialty, I think, is I teach a course on police stress. And that's, I guess, in a way what kind of brings John, you and I together, is looking at ways that, you know, from your standpoint, looking at officers, and from my standpoint, I'm trying to train students who want to become officers what to expect, you know, in that class from a stress standpoint, ways that they can identify, see the early warning signs, and ways that they can help themselves. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate the background. And before we're finished, I want to get back and talk about your disability, because, you know, I know so many other cops that have sports injuries that they either got before they were police officers or while they were working as police officers. And I think the issue of disabled police officers is one that we really need to talk about in our profession, because I think it's a growing population, and maybe you'll share some of your perspectives with us later about, you know, how that went and how it made you feel. But before we get to that, let's back up a little bit and let's talk about your specialty and that area that brought us together, and that is wellness for police officers, and specifically how we deal with stress. You are one of the few people that I've met that has actually experienced a severe bout with PTSD and was able to work through that and stay on the job and manage that. And I think it's important for other officers to hear from you about your perspective. I've seen you teach, and I know that other cops sit there in rapt attention because you're giving a perspective on something they've heard about but maybe haven't had any opportunity to experience either personally or through their agency. So would you mind sharing your story, and we'll talk about that a little bit so that everybody listening can get a perspective on what it's like to go through that.
Absolutely. For me, I guess in a way, kind of my journey began, unfortunately, on a date that I'll probably never forget, I don't think, in the rest of my life. And that is October 5th, 2001. And in just for a little bit of background, and this is kind of what I had taught John, and I know you'd seen that, but for me, what happened on October 5th, 2001, middle of the night, got called out to a residential house fire in our city, where unfortunately three very young boys died. They were ranged in ages from 10 to 11, and you know, I can vividly remember I got the call, went into work, and immediately met with my chief of police. Prior to this fire, in August 27th of the same year, marked the birth of our first daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I had been back to work since, you know, being on a leave with for a couple weeks anyhow with my wife and our new child. And everything, you know, to me was normal. I'd been called out several times in the middle of my night and career, especially working detectives in a metro area, and investigated, you know, numerous, unfortunately, deaths involving young people, kids, teenagers, and even adults. Mm-hmm. But on that particular night, what I found kind of interesting was when I got out to the hospital, and all of the boys had been, the firefighters were able to get them out of the house, but unfortunately, you know, first responders, doctors, medics, were not able to revive them, though they had attempted to at the hospital. So that was where I went first, because I knew that the three boys were there, as well as the mother of one of the children. These boys had been staying overnight at one of the victim's house for a weeknight sleepover, which followed a birthday party that they had at the local bowling alley for one of the boys who had turned 11. And so when I got to the hospital, and I put my hand on the door to the emergency room, I remember just kind of this real loud buzzing sound, and everything kind of started spinning on me, and I ended up having to grab the door, and I felt like I was going to pass out, and I couldn't understand why. I didn't know if it was because I got up too quickly and, you know, kind of wasn't fully alert. And so I took a few deep breaths, and everything kind of went back to normal, and I proceeded into the hospital, and as soon as I broke the door into the emergency room, and I had that smell of, you know, like a sterile smell from an emergency room, I had the exact same feeling again. Got this real loud buzzing sound in my ear. Things were spinning. I thought I was, you know, going to pass out. And I had to repeat the process again. I had to take a few deep breaths, and eventually was able to go in. And I worked that entire night. Interviewed the mom for a couple different hours. The mother was not present at the time that the fire started. It was later determined that the mom was not home. The fire had started because she had left the residence. She had claimed to go to a local store because she was refinishing some furniture out in the garage late at night. And when she had gone there, she left about approximately 15 candles burning in the living room of the house, and the candles happened to be right below the second floor bedroom where the boys were staying. Mm. And it's our belief that one of the cats in the house had knocked over one of the candles, and subsequently the fire started. Mm-hmm. There were smoke detectors in the house. None of them were working. None of them had batteries in them. There were renters in the Way basement who noticed the smoke, and they were the ones that had called police that night. So, we worked through the night, and I'd gone out to the local store that the mother had claimed she was at in the morning to talked with the owner there, got some security footage, and finally at about maybe 10 or 10:30 in the morning was the first opportunity that I had just to stop home, kind of check in, say hi to my wife, and say hi to my daughter. And I, to this day, vividly remember walking through the door, and my wife just happened to be standing in the kitchen holding our daughter. And I remember just walking over to them. I didn't say a word. I remember just grabbing my daughter, out of my wife's arms, and I just held her, and I just started crying. I just lost it. After seeing those boys and realizing how fragile life was and seeing the trauma that those other parents had to go through that night when they got that message, it really hit me hard. Mm-hmm. I ended up, stayed for a few minutes, talked, and I ended up, having to go back to work. And I worked up until December. And at the time that I was working for Hutchinson, I was still working part-time for Minnesota State Mankato as an adjunct faculty member. I was just teaching one class a semester. And it was somewhere right around the first week of December, and I remember, quite vividly teaching a class that night and driving home. I usually always taught night classes because of my work schedule, and my mind just started racing. I started having all these questions in my head, and thinking back over the last, probably at that point six, 7 years of my career, and the amount of time that I'd focused on kids and all the tragedies, and my mind just started going off in I don't know how many different directions. Don't remember being able to really stop any of the thought processes. Couldn't tell you how I got home that night. Couldn't tell you the route that I took. Yeah. And it's really about all I remember of that night. The next morning, my wife woke up and found me on a couch, curled up in the fetal position, and I was just sobbing uncontrollably. And I just simply couldn't function. I was in a complete state of anxiety and panic, and which was very scary. I'd never experienced that in my life. I couldn't stop it. I couldn't control it. Scared my wife because she didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate because I knew a psychologist that worked in the metro area and dealt with law enforcement officers quite a bit. In fact, he had, for various reasons, had spoken with some other people that I had worked with before. And so I gave his office a call, and I said, I don't know what's going on. And the other thing that was real fortunate for me was at the time my chief of police, I had called him at his residence that evening and asked if I could come over and talk to him. And it was really fortunate because he himself had, experienced something similar to PTSD or was PTSD. I don't want to misspeak. But, first thing he said is, you need to get some time away from work. You need to get some help. So right away I just, he said, I'll take care of, notifying your supervisor and stay away from the job and go see somebody. So I did call and I got an appointment right away and was able to go into the cities and see the psychologist. And, after meeting with him, immediately diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress disorder and began to set up a series of regular appointments. Also prescribed some medication for me for antidepressant for anxiety. Mm-hmm. And things kind of went on from there. It was a slow progress, and it is a lot of work for you yourself, because you can't, at least what I found is that the medication definitely helps, but you can't rely completely on the medication. And I was, you know, really fortunate that that this psychologist, Dr. Lowell Campbell is his name, and he was able to teach me a lot of stress management techniques where I could slow down the thought processes you know, basically use, like, for example, the antidepressant medication on a regular basis, but any medication for anxiety was only in, you know, emergency situations if you couldn't get grasp of it, you know. And so somewhere around, I probably want to say I was out of work maybe 2.5-3 weeks, and then I started going back to work, light duty, but was still having regular appointments. One thing that was kind of interesting, and maybe this is something that we can talk about as well, too, John, is at the time, my chief was insistent that he wanted me to file a workers' compensation claim related to the post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And I can vividly remember, you know, him explaining why he wanted me to do it. And ultimately, I got a letter back from the insurance provider, and what they stated was that a if I remember the wording correctly, that a mental injury without a physical injury to go along with it does not meet the requirements for workers' compensation.
Really?
And, you know, thought that was kind of a interesting dynamic, that you have to have a physical injury,
yeah,
to go along with a, you know, a mental injury. But nonetheless, I, you know, did go back to work and was able to continue working on that case. I was still assigned to the house fire. And actually, I had that case up until the following fall. So almost eight months that I worked on that case until we finally got the lead I wanted, and we were able to show and get the mother to admit that she had been out the previous evening, and when she had left the house, she had actually been out delivering and selling narcotics, which, you know, added another difficult part mentally and emotionally to this case.
Right.
That those three boys, you know, had to die for that.
Yeah.
One of the things, though, that probably was more interesting, and one of the things where I'm trying to do now with my students, based on my own experience and other people that I've talked to, is there were warning signs that were out there, and I simply just didn't see them. Whether it was because I was ignoring them, I'm not sure, but nobody around me saw them either. Like I said, my first daughter had been born on August 27th, and after 1 week, or, you know, a couple days in the hospital, we brought her home. Had to deal with a little bit of jaundice, things like that. But it was about 6 days, maybe, I want to say, after she was born. It was a Saturday. At that time in my career with Hutchinson, I was assigned to the special response team. And our pagers went off. It was a hostage situation. And, you know, without even thinking that, you know, you're home on maternity leave, stay home.
Yeah.
You know, the pager goes off, and, well, I got to go to work.
Right.
And I remember it was a really hot day. You know, we have a lot of humidity here in Minnesota. It was temperatures in the 90s, and the situation, it was a domestic violence situation with a boyfriend, girlfriend. She had been hit over the head with a board. I think it was like 2x4. She was able to get out of and flee the apartment, but she wasn't able to get her 3-year-old child out of the apartment, and no contact with the individual inside. And so, you know, we were going on the assumption that this was a hostage situation with this three-year-old.
Right.
And, of course, it was on the third floor of this complex. And my partner and I, our position was essentially the point position from the entrance to the hallway from the stair corridor. And the apartment door was just a few doors down from that. And I remember, you know, having my rifle. I remember, you know, watching the door. And all of a sudden, the next thing I remember, I wake up and I'm on my back and I'm down on the first floor of the stair casing, and all of my gear is off. Mm-hmm. And my partner was standing over me and he's like, "You passed out." And so they, you know, got somebody to cover my position and brought me out. And my chief, you know, rightfully was, and made me go to the hospital and get evaluated. And the emergency room doctor was like, "You know, you haven't slept in 6 days. You got a new baby. This is fatigue and heat exhaustion and dehydration, you know." And I'm like, "Well, of course that, you know, that makes sense." And then the other thing that was happening during this process, and I've got, you know, in my presentation that I did out in Littleton with you, I've got pictures. But my physical appearance changes quite a bit. I'm, you know, I'm 6 feet tall, 6 foot one, I'm 230 pounds, and I've got a blonde hair with a crew cut. And, you know, some of the things that now that I look back at pictures, I can start seeing, you know, slowly from kind of from the late August time is pretty soon I don't start putting my flat top back up. I'm wearing my glasses a lot because all the crying that I was doing, my contacts were burning my eyes. And, you know, I just wasn't picking up on these were signs of stress and that it was just things were getting spinning out of control. And so one of the questions that was asked at least of me in Littleton was, well, was it, you know, was it then the, was it the birth of your daughter that caused this? Or, and my answer is, you know, no, that's not what caused it. I think that's what kind of changed my perception though,
right.
as far as law enforcement was concerned. Because now I had something very precious that I was going to do everything in the world to protect, and I kept seeing all these horrible things happening. It came out later in one of my sessions with my psychologist that the SWAT team call out where I passed out, I kept picturing my daughter on the other side of the door. And how was I going to get her out of that hostage situation? It simply, you know, causes overload in the brain.
Yeah.
Same thing with the house fire. You know, I just kept picturing, okay, when I get called out to go to work, you know, who's home? And I think a lot of us in law enforcement feel that, you know, who's home protecting my family when I'm out, protecting the community? Because even though we live in nice communities, we know as officers the bad things that go bump in the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those things were building up, and for me, the house fire was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But it didn't present itself, you know, immediately. It presented itself about 2 months later. So,
yeah.
But the good news for me was that I was able to learn to manage my stress and my PTSD and my emotions. Through a combination of medication, through my own techniques in stress management. I tell my story every semester to the new students that come into my police stress class.
Mm-hmm.
I get them all hyped up that there's going to be a guest speaker, and then I walk into the room. But when it's done, it's good therapeutically for me to talk about it. When I gave the presentation in Littleton, that was the first time I actually gave it to an audience of officers. And I was nervous because I know being an officer, what hard critics we can be. A lot of times we don't want to be at training. We don't like to go to training. We bring other work, or sometimes we catch a cat nap at training. And, so I just didn't know how it was, it was going to be perceived. And I was very fortunate that at least the officers that I talked to, were very appreciative of it. And, the only reason that I do it, John, and you and I have talked about this, is that I felt like I was the majority of law enforcement, and that this could never happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. And I didn't see it coming. And I guess my thought is, if it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
So the better prepared we can be so that it doesn't catch you off guard and you do pick up on the warning signs, before you end up in a state of complete panic and anxiety, because it's a terrible feeling. So
I appreciate you sharing that with us, and let me now walk in the shoes of every other police officer that's listening. I'm sure it scares us all to death. We don't want to be vulnerable. We don't want to have another weakness. I write the things I write for Cops Alive because I think we spend an awful lot of time and energy training to fight and deal with the bad guys and protect ourselves from guns and knives and bombs, and yet we're not doing anything to protect ourselves psychologically. And I think this specter of PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, scares the hell out of most cops because they don't know how to fight it and they don't know how to deal with it. And I remember when you and I first met and you described it, you just said it a minute ago, it caught you completely off guard, and it rendered you, useless there for that first couple of days, I guess. And you didn't even know how to cope with that. And so I'm kind of wondering what you can share with other cops to put this whole thing into perspective, because you did get through it and
Right.
you did learn to understand it. And now you actually even teach stress management. So can you put that into a perspective that'll maybe alleviate some of the fears of other police officers listening?
Yeah. And interestingly enough, police stress, unfortunately, is not a topic that we are teaching on a regular basis. The police stress class that we teach, I do look at other universities that have law enforcement programs, and we have several, associate degree law enforcement programs here in Minnesota. In Minnesota, it's a requirement by post that you were mandated to have an associate degree in law enforcement to be a full-time officer.
Mm-hmm.
But there are very few, if any, universities teaching this. And if we're not teaching it at the university, I'm also finding that we're not doing in-service training related to this. The majority of our in-service training has to do, like you said, with learning how to fight. We're out at the range, we're training with our firearms, we're training with batons and tasers and mace, and our defensive tactics and handcuffing techniques, and we're doing everything we can to protect the physical, and we're doing nothing to protect the mental. And I think that is very evident in when we look at, historically, as the years are going on, and fortunately this year the way it's going is not going to fall in that category, but we've been reducing the number of officers being killed in the line of duty feloniously.
Right.
And accidentally, for that matter, too, with driver's training and pursuit driving training. But nobody talks about the hundreds of officers nationwide every year that commit suicide. And I think a lot of those officers, if there were a way that we could talk to them and learn from them, I think those officers that do commit suicide, we'd find that they do, in fact, or are, in fact, suffering or were from post-traumatic stress disorder. Because, again, it's for a lot of officers, it's just something that we don't think about. We don't see that side of law enforcement on TV. And so it's just, it wasn't something that I was watching for. I felt like I was in the, at that time, I was in the prime of my career.
Yeah.
At that time was now in my, basically like my sixth or seventh year of investigations. Felt comfortable really handling almost any case that I had. I'd worked on homicides, and but again, you know, we've got stress in our personal lives, and just because it's a joyous event doesn't mean that it doesn't cause stress. Birth of a child, as great as it is a stressful event for anybody that has kids. We all know that. And when you start adding that in, and you add in the fears I think most officers, if you really had a chance to sit down and talk to them individually, would tell you that there are fears that they have. And I think a lot of it has to do with, well, you know, I work the night shift, and you know, it's scary for either my husband or my wife to be home with my family. And maybe I work in a neighboring jurisdiction, so I can't even patrol past the house. You know, who's protecting them?
Right.
I think we see it in how overprotective we are, but most officers wouldn't tell you it's because they fear something's going to happen. It's just what you do. You know, there's so much, I love the word machismo, because that there is. It's a very macho career. You know, and we're supposed to be there to hold up the community and people under any circumstance, and not cry, not break down. And like you said, who's there then to hold us up? So, you know, for me, here's basically, I guess what I kind of consider my recipe for success. And I think, John, this is what we have to be aware of, is that it's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah.
Because everybody's background is different. One of the things that I wasn't aware of is that it's not significant, but there is some history of mental illness within my family. You know, back into grandparents into great grandparents and uncle, you know, that distant of relation, but yet it's there. You know, one of the things that I found over the years, I've tried a couple different times to, you know, thinking, okay, I've got a good grip on this. I don't need the antidepressants anymore. And within a couple days, there's a significant change, in me. And it's not for the better. And so what I've come to accept is that I have a chemical imbalance, and the medication helps to stabilize that. And then when I throw in my different stress management techniques that work for me, I mean, there's a lot of them out there. You need proper instruction on them. The training that you and I were at with Lisa Wimberger, Lisa teaches grounding techniques, and for some people that works very well. For some, it doesn't work. So you have to kind of experiment with the different techniques that are out there, find the ones that work for you, and use them. But you really have to dedicate yourself to them. You have to make time to do it on a regular basis. You have to recognize what the warning signs are within you personally, and you need to listen to them.
Yeah,
and
that's probably key right there.
You know, finally for me, the other thing was I chose not to keep this a quiet little dirty secret. I wasn't afraid to tell my coworkers that I had been through this, partly because I don't want any officer to ever have to feel like I felt that morning,
mm-hmm.
Because to be mentally completely out of control and have no idea how you get that back is extremely scary. I mean, it was just like, I, you know, for me, any thoughts of suicide, I never had any intention or any thoughts about hurting myself, but I was just scared. I was so afraid for the future. I had no idea what anything was going to hold. And we don't know that You know, I can say that now that it's okay. I don't know what the future is going to hold, and all I can do is, you know, hope for the best and prepare. But when you're out of control, it's extremely scary. And other people that I've talked to that suffer from, you know, anxiety attacks and things, that it's the worst feeling in the world. And I don't want anybody to go through that. So I reached out to my three F's, the first being faith, the second being family, and the third being friends. And I made sure that my family and my close friends knew what had happened. I made sure they knew the warning signs so that in the event I didn't see it and they saw it, I wanted them to say something to me, so that I could deal with it. You know, looking back, even my wife didn't really. Yeah, I mean, she sees the changes now after it happened, but just like me, didn't put the pieces of the puzzle together. So that's, you know, I guess kind of my summation for it.
Thank you. I appreciate you being so candid about what you've experienced. Are there any resources that you want to recommend to people? I know you use a book in your training program. I don't want to put you on the spot. I actually bought a copy of it, thanks to you, but it's not here on my desk in front of me, so I don't know if you want to quote that or not, but I'll make sure I include it in the blog article that goes with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of different textbooks out there, and as I'm starting my career now in teaching, I'm trying to buy as many as I can and read them to see which is, you know, what's good and what's not. But one of the books that I use, and it's a requirement for my class, and I can't stress it enough because it's a simple read. It explains things very well, and it offers a lot of good advice on ways to prevent it. But it's Kevin Gilmartin, Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, writes a book, and Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. And I think if you've had a chance to read it, John, it's spot on. I think most officers that read that, even if they've been on the job 2 to 3 years, I think can identify with almost every aspect of the book. We have a lot of different stress in law enforcement. And I think a lot of officers will tell you that they have stress with management and administration. And I think that's going to be, unfortunately, the nature of our beast in this job. Because a lot of times for us, it's hard to look at, you know, the job of the administrator and understand that they've got limitations. We don't necessarily see that. A lot of times we take that as non-support, and unfortunately in some cases, because certainly not always, but it talks about a variety of different stressors, but gives a lot of good basic recipes that work. I don't know if recipes is the best word, but essentially what I have found is I have to have a toolbox. I have to have a toolbox filled with things that I can use to manage this and cope with this on a daily basis. You know, like I said, I was very fortunate. I feel that I was able to go back to work for another 7 years after my bout of PTSD because, unfortunately, you know, some officers don't get to go back. It unfortunately is too damaging for them. And so I consider myself very fortunate from that standpoint. However, on the backside of it, and another topic that you'd kind of alluded to, I never would have anticipated that I would be told by a doctor that I can't do this job anymore. And in hindsight, I'm really fortunate that I you have to forgive me, it's a little hard, but I'm actually glad that I went through this back in 2001 so that I had these techniques, because being disabled from something you love so much and being told you can't do it anymore, the stress I had from that doesn't even touch the first bout that I had. And I'm just really fortunate that I had those techniques and I could see it coming right away, and I was able to deal with it, because I don't know where I would have been, quite frankly, if I hadn't been through it before and recognized the signs, because, you know, having to leave an agency we all identify ourselves as a cop, and essentially having that taken away from you is tough. It's really tough.
Yeah, I've talked with a number of other officers that have been disabled in one way or the other, and just as you described PTSD, it always catches you off guard. It's never something you planned for, usually. And I think you actually have been able to turn this into something very positive, but I know a lot of officers who feel completely left in limbo because they have no backup plan. You know, particularly in your field of education, there are a lot of cops that have never gotten their college degree. Many of us never had any jobs before we became cops. And so if something suddenly ends our career, there's, for most people, there's nothing else out there. There's nothing else to fall back on. And because law enforcement becomes such an integral part of your personality and your it's interwoven with your self-esteem, it leaves an awful lot of police officers completely devastated.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And you're right, John. I consider myself very fortunate. And that's another aspect that I talk about with my students, and especially, you know, in advising sessions when they come in and say, you know, I'm thinking about picking up a minor, and you know, what do you think it should be in? And you know, and like, use me like an open book, you know, use me as an example that I don't care if you're the strongest, most fit officer that can run, you know, 15 miles a day, and we just never know when things happen. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if the only college you've had is maybe an associate or even a bachelor's, but you didn't have any other specialty, you've never had any other real long-term job other than, you know, college jobs and high school jobs, and also 10 years into this career that happens, and our training in law enforcement is so unique. We can't just take what we learned and apply it to you know, right away the business world. In some regards, and so you're right. A lot of officers are left there. I don't know. I mean, certainly, I never got into this job to be rich. I think we all know that.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't feel like I have ever lived above my means, but. I don't think the lifestyle that we were living would have significantly changed if I was not able to, you know, go back to another job.
Yeah.
Because at least the way, you know, it's set up here in Minnesota, on the medical disability, I ended up, I now get a disability check, and it's 60% of what I was making, essentially, at the time I went out.
Mm-hmm.
And that that would not have sustained. I mean, we would have had to have major changes had I not ever been able to go back to any type of job. So you're right. From that regard, I consider myself very fortunate. And I think it's something that officers should think about, should look at. Because we just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that we try to write about in Cops Alive, and we include in our training, is that concept, you know, in law enforcement, we're always talking about backup. We, you know, we have backup for a call. You plan backup, you know, in a lot of your planning, you know, let's just say we're tactically setting up outside of a armed robbery or a bank robbery situation. We think about backup. We even talk about backup when it comes to our computer systems. And yet when we talk about our careers and having some other skill that we can fall back on, most of us have never taken time to think about that. And if you're listening to this, maybe now is a good time to make a few notes to yourself to go back and work on that education or get that computer degree or start that business on the side so that you have something else in your life besides this job that we all find so precious, but that can be so unpredictable.
Yeah. And I think, too, John, I mean, there's a lot of different resources out on the Internet now. There's a lot of different sites related, you know, to officers that you can take a look at. And some of them that I've read where, you know, even officers that made it through their career and are in a state of, you know, service retirement, if they don't have another job, they're just lost,
right.
Because they miss it.
Yep.
You know, every day they wake up and their identity, you know, that is gone. And it's such a, and it's an identity that we hold so near and dear to our hearts that it's very hard to walk away. And I'm just as guilty as anybody else. But one of the things that was probably the hardest for me was, and I've read about this on discussion forums and blogs and. But other officers have talked about, you know, when you go out on some type of major illness or surgery, my fusion surgery, I had to take 3 months off of work. And it was just amazing how, you know, immediately the visits and the phone calls dropped to, you know, the few real close, true friends. But it certainly didn't feel like the department was there. And then to go in and to tell your employer that you can't get medical clearance from your doctor because of the way things ended up. I mean, it's out of your control. And, and I understand how, you know, laws work as far as disability accommodations. But, you know, the bottom line is I could not be a licensed police officer. Mm-hmm. And, there just was, you know, nothing from, at least, you know, for me, from my experience with my employer. That could have kept me affiliated with the city or the organization. And it's just like overnight, you're gone. You're not a cop anymore. The department, they're not stopping by. They're not seeing how you're doing. They're not calling. They move on. And sadly enough, as I think back and I'm talking to probably my best friend who's unfortunately in a worse situation but very similar with his back, we were talking about this concept here just a couple weeks ago, and he made a very interesting remark to me as he said, you know, remember all of the officers that had service retirements and how after they were gone we'd sit around and say, well, why don't they stop in at the PD anymore? Why don't they come in and have coffee? And now that I'm on this side of it, I'm like, well, why didn't we ever call them and invite them? You know, other than the once a year Christmas party get together or something. But, you know, why don't we, because they're gone, why aren't we reaching out to them still?
Yeah.
If we know that's how they're feeling, you know, we should be doing that. So I'm just as guilty as anybody else of doing it. But after being on this side of it, I can tell you it's really tough. It's really tough.
Now, you and I were talking earlier. I've heard the exact same remarks from disabled police officers and, as you mentioned, even retired police officers and survivors of law enforcement line of duty deaths. They all talk about, you know, all of a sudden all the communication just stops and, you know, it's a train. The train keeps on going and a lot of people are left behind. And I think personally, we in the profession need to, you know, clean that house up ourselves. We always talk about being one big family. We always talk about not leaving anybody behind. We always talk about taking care of our own. And yet, for whatever reason, maybe we're afraid, maybe we're embarrassed, maybe we don't want the reminder of the potential of disability or the potential of line of duty death.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever the reason, we tend to stop communicating. And I think that's something that we need to change, and it needs to be not only an individual effort, but I think a departmental effort, because it can't be left on the shoulders of one or two people. It should be a team effort, and there should be mechanisms in place to keep people involved and keep in touch with them. And I don't know, every department probably handles that differently, but let me just say this to the audience. If you know of a great example of how that works, send us an email at Cops Alive and let us know. We'll do a story about that. But it is an area that I think we are lacking in, and I appreciate you being candid about it, and maybe this will be a call to action to wake people up and say, well, we need to worry about that now before it actually happens in our agency.
Yeah, I hope so, John. And I, like you and I have talked, it's really an area that that I think we do need to explore because, you know, whether it is a service retirement or whether it is a line of duty retirement, or you know, in my case, you know, I had officers say to me, "Well, why aren't you filing workers' compensation?" You know, this, I mean, I came into this career with this injury, and certainly being a police officer did not help my back in any, you know, it added to the deterioration of an existing injury. But, I mean, I didn't have a specific incident where everything went bad. I mean, it just, over time, it just gave out.
Yeah.
It's somewhat of a genetic issue that I had. My mother also had a similar situation several years ago, many years ago, actually, with her low back. So, you know, that was all part of it. And I'm like, no, that's, you know, that's not what that's for. And I think, you know, unfortunately, there is that stigma that, you know, everybody that goes out on a medical disability is doing so on workers' compensation, and it's not justified, and that's simply, you know, not true.
Yeah.
Workers' compensation is there for a reason, and those officers that do become injured on the job, absolutely, in my opinion, they deserve and have, you know, the right to access that.
Yeah.
I simply wasn't going to tap into it because I don't feel, even to this day, it applied to my situation. But it doesn't matter what type it is, you know, like I said, whether it's a service retirement, it's just interesting that, you know, somebody could work 30 years and overnight we decide that volume of knowledge and information and experience is no longer needed and we can just put that book on a shelf and let it collect dust.
Yeah.
There's still things that we could use that person for. And we could keep them involved in, like you said, John, a family.
Right.
And we talk about that all the time. It was, in fact, it's interesting because you and I both saw it unsolicited when we did our training in Littleton, and Lisa asked the officers in attendance, or actually it was one of the officers wanted to make a comment. He said, it's interesting that, you know, in this profession, you know, if you make it to the end of your career and you have a service retirement, then we have a, you know, farewell party for you, and we you know, lavish you with gifts and thank you and all this stuff. On the, you know, the unfortunate times when officers are killed in the line of duty, you know, we have huge funerals to pay tribute, and it's so appropriate and it's so fitting. But yet, when we've got people who leave on a disability or whatever it would be, before, you know, quote unquote, their time is up, it's just like we kick it to the curb. And I think it happens for a lot of individual reasons, a lot of individual feelings that go into it, but it happens. And it's something that, you're right, we need to address, because it's a bigger issue than we think it is.
I agree. I really appreciate your candor and certainly your time to share your story with everyone listening, and I commend you for what you're doing and, you know, what you've done to take these challenges and turn them into strengths and be able to still go out and help other people in the law enforcement profession or those going into it. And so I want to say thank you. I'm kind of curious, what does the future hold for you? I know you're working on your PhD. What's the future hold?
Yeah, well, like I said, we never know. You know, the future for me is, like you said, right now I'm trying to get to complete my PhD. And the finishing part of that will be a dissertation, and certainly strong inclination right now. My research interests lie in this area, in stress management, you know, how do we help cops better armor themselves so that they can have a healthy career and they can have a healthy retirement. So, you know, certainly research down those lines. I guess, you know, coming out to Lisa's training with you was kind of my first experience, but I just really feel like it's my responsibility to kind of pay it forward, like you and I talk, John. And I want people, I don't want people to hear my story because I don't need pity. I don't want sympathy, but what I hope people will take from it, or officers will take from it, is that the realization that it really can happen to anybody, and that we need to prepare ourselves for it. We need to make sure that we have techniques in place. We need to make sure that we have support systems within friends and family, and you know, faith, if that's you know, part of the equation for you. But we need to make sure that we're ready for it in the event that it does happen, because getting hit over the head with it and waking up with it one day is not a good way. I certainly don't know any statistics, but from what I see, I don't really know that it's a real high success rate. I feel very fortunate to have been able to go back and to be able to manage this. So that's really why, at this point, why I'm wanting to do it is, I don't want anybody else to have to go through that. And if I can help that in any way, that's certainly what I want to do. So we'll just have to see what the future will hold. But I guess what I can see at this point. So.
Well, thanks. And we've talked, and we may actually, you may be hearing more from us. We found that it was a really comprehensive training when we coupled some of our anecdotes and stories with what Lisa Wimberger does at TCPG, TPCG, to do stress management training. So we certainly think that's important, and we may be doing a lot more of that in the future. But again, Chris, I thank you for your time here, and I thank you for your willingness to share. And I really appreciate you being our guest today.
It's my pleasure, John. And like I said, I hope an audience hears it, and I hope it helps. And hopefully, we'll continue to do some stuff down the line. And if there's anything that I can do to help you, I'm happy to do that. Also, if there are people that listen and they wanted to get in touch with me, if you don't mind, I'll just my email address. The best way to get a hold of me, it's Christian.Dobratz at mnsu.edu, and happy to answer any questions if people have that. So,
excellent. Thank you very much, and I want to thank everyone also for listening. You've been listening to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin, where we try to bring you all the tips and tools and suggestions and strategies we can give you to help you survive your career in law enforcement. This website, Cops Alive, was founded to provide information and strategies to help police officers survive their careers. And we do that by working with you and your agencies to try to prepare for the risks that might threaten your future. We do that with training, with podcasts like the one you've been listening to, with information on our blog at copsalive.com. And we feel that this is a partnership. It is cops helping other cops. So by all means, please write to us, give us a call, let us know what you've got to share with your fellow police officers, and let us know what you'd like to know more about, because we would always welcome story ideas, suggestions, and information to help us in our research. But once again, this is John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com, and I thank you very much for listening. Have a good day and stay safe out there.